So I talked to a journalist friend on and off throughout the pandemic, and she's been saying all the time, epidemiologists, they all say it depends when I ask them questions.
How dare they?
It's a show about medicine.
Please remain indoors.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Labos.
And the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead, jeez.
And we're gonna look at the evidence behind medical topics, and the show is
called... Wait, no, I wanna say it.
I wanna say it.
I came up with it. It's the body of... It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
We are joined by Gid M.K., an epidemiologist working in diabetes and chronic disease from the University of Wollongong in Australia near Sydney. He blogs on Medium.com. He hosts a podcast called Sensationalist Science. And under the moniker Health Nerd, he frequently evaluates the reliability of scientific studies on Twitter, where he has over 33,000 followers. Gid, welcome to the show.
Yes, welcome, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, first question, where is Australia exactly? And does it actually exist?
Look, I've been told it doesn't exist. So far, I mean, it's a bit solipsistic, but I think, therefore I am, right?
Right.
I've never been to Canada, so for all I know, you guys are a fiction.
That is true.
Yes, we might just be voices in your head.
Yeah,
exactly.
So you have recently been taunting the rest of the world by posting photos of yourself on the beach in Australia, attending events with other people, I think. I mean, basically living as if the pandemic is over. And that's what we wanted to talk to you about, which is that the COVID-19 pandemic affects all of us, but different governments have enacted different measures, which have been adopted or pushed back against by different cultures. It creates differences that we can look at. And so we wanted to get an idea of how Australia has dealt with the pandemic, because from my perspective anyway, and I think from the perspective of other people in the rest of the world, it seems like your country has done an admirable job. So let's go back a year or more. Do you remember learning about this new virus, and when did you think that this would get very serious?
Yeah, well, I was traveling in Europe in February 2020.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I actually, so my wife is a surgeon and she was in Europe to do her exams for the European boards. And so after she did her exams, we had plans to travel around, amazingly enough, Northern Italy, as well as Southern Germany and Austria. Yes. So in what is now an astonishing coincidence, I don't know, we were in Milan on February 24th, and we caught a train up to Zurich where we flew back to Sydney.
Huh.
Yeah.
Is it possible that you were patient zero in Australia then?
No. Actually, by the time we got back to Australia, I believe the first person had already passed away from COVID. Mm. The first case in Australia was 26th of January.
I see. What was Australia's sort of immediate response during that first wave when there were so many unknowns about this virus?
Yeah, well, you said, like, when did you know it became serious? And so I actually, before I left, I was having a conversation with my boss, and my boss is a very experienced professor who spent most of his life working with the CDC and the WHO on chronic disease, but also a bit on infectious disease. And I remember a discussion very well where he said, "Oh, I think it's going to be a global pandemic. You should take care in Europe." And I said, "Oh, I don't know. It doesn't sound like it will be." And this was mid-January. I was a bit naive at the time to the dangers of a global pandemic, certainly. But flying back really opened my eyes. And then the week after, because almost immediately as the outbreak in Italy happened, Australia enacted quite a few border restrictions. I'm not sure what good the immediate border restrictions did, but then we intensified those quite substantially. So since mid-March in Australia, if you were returning from any country, mid-March 2020 this is, You've had to quarantine in a dedicated quarantine facility, and we use mostly hotels for that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the first things that happened. Alongside those initial restrictions, the government put in place, I mean, you know, lockdowns have been very, the term lockdown is a heterogeneous term. It differs from place to place quite a bit. What one country calls a lockdown, another country says, well, that just sounds like normal life. But in New South Wales, particularly where I lived, they implemented almost a year ago today, towards the end of March, a fairly restrictive set of measures that included, you know, not leaving your house unless you were doing one of a certain set number of things, closing a lot of businesses, no in-person dining in restaurants, that sort of thing. And that lasted until mid-May.
So we're going to test your knowledge of Canada now. Do you know when Canada implemented mandatory quarantine in a dedicated facility after international travel?
So I have been trying to keep up with every country that has done this. And forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think Canada has never done that.
We did it last month, I think, roughly.
Last month, okay.
Yeah, we basically went a year with... sort of the idea of first no quarantine, and then sort of a mild suggestion that you should close a quarantine, and then increasingly affirmative statements that quarantining was necessary and then mandatory, and then finally deciding, no, we're going to keep you in a hotel for at least 3 days until you test negative, and then you can do the rest of your quarantine at home.
Yeah, so in Australia, the mandatory hotel quarantine, I think, was brought in towards the end of March. I'd have to check the exact date. I have a friend who returned from Britain in early April, and she was one of the in the first wave of hotel quarantine back when it was quite swanky, because the government didn't really... now the government has got long-term tenders for relatively cheap hotels, but then they were just scrounging for whichever hotel was out of business. So my friend was in the Harbourside Marriott in a very nice room with beautiful catering. Also back then, originally the government paid for the hotel quarantine entirely. Now when you return, you have to pay $3,000 for your quarantine.
And do you have to quarantine in hotels for the full 2 week period, or like when you
come
back?
Yes, you're given a room that you basically can't leave. There are some quarantine facilities, particularly for people who are vulnerable or have mental health issues, where you have access to courtyards and you can walk around a lot, but particularly in the bigger cities, so Sydney, Perth, Melbourne, most of the facilities are just a hotel room where you stay.
I know that you heard from people saying that Australia got lucky, right? It's a tropical country, or it's an island. Some people claiming you don't have public transportation. Apparently, the seasons are reversed. Like, what do you make of all of these attempted explanations for how well Australia seemingly did with dealing with the coronavirus?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's always some element of luck. To every situation. It's a stochastic process that there is some random variation. But the idea that it's all down to luck is absolutely nonsensical. You know, I had an absurd conversation with this guy, with this economist, who was saying that Australia is a remote Pacific island and implying that Sydney and Melbourne are tiny cities with no public transport, which is... Yeah, I mean, for reference, you know, Milan is a third the size of Sydney, both in population and in size. We have a very large dedicated public transport system, buses, trains, underground. We've built a metro. You know, it's while it's a very spread out city, there are very high density areas, and it's not unlike going to what's a good example, like LA. But LA is obviously a bigger city.
Yeah, but LA is endless. LA. It's enormous.
Exactly. So is Sydney. I mean, Sydney is geographically bigger than London, but it has half the population.
I see. So you're not living in huts, is what you're saying?
No, I mean, it's especially ridiculous when people tell it to me, given that I live in one of the highest density suburbs in the city. I live about 4 kilometers from the city center. And, you know, I live in an area that is all apartments.
You should document this, Gid, and like post photos online of what Sydney looks like, because apparently some people think you're all living in huts, rubbing sticks together to make a fire.
Well, it's an interesting contrast, because the thing about Sydney is it's this massive urban sprawl. So you've got very high density areas in the center of the city, like most cities. But when you go out to the suburbs, they really are much more spread out than the suburbs in other cities. Mm. You know, and partly that's also because we've got these huge national parks. I mean, Australia is vast, right? There are national parks in Sydney, in the area that's considered Greater Sydney, that are bigger than some cities in Europe.
Wow, I see. So Australia kind of, you know, clamped down very early on. But then I noticed you wrote something a few months later. You wrote, "Sadly, despite this, all of our measures failed. In May 2020, what began as a minor outbreak from hotel quarantine in the city of Melbourne, population 5 million, exploded into the worst epidemic the country has seen. The state of Victoria went almost overnight from a handful of local cases of the disease to hundreds a day and many thousands in total." I was wondering what exactly happened at that point.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's an inquest to decide exactly whose fault it is. But basically, there was an unfortunate event in which the hotel quarantine system broke down. Someone who had traveled into Australia infected a security guard, I believe, or the manager of a security guard company, who then infected a bunch of other guards, and they spread a very large outbreak. And so that started what has been to date the biggest outbreak in Australia. You know, Victoria suffered quite a bit. There were, I think, in total about 30,000 cases in Victoria, or 25,000. And it was not an insignificant outbreak. Nearly 1,000 people died. But what happened almost immediately was that the state of Victoria, and this, so for context, for the listeners who may not be aware, 22nd of May is the middle of Victorian winter. Victoria is one of the colder cities in Australia. So think, you know, halfway between London and Paris kind of winter. I don't know what that would be for Canada, probably middle of summer, I guess.
Hey, now.
So Melbourne winter, it gets pretty cold. It doesn't go below zero too much, 0 degrees Celsius, but it's relatively chilly, particularly for Australia. And they locked down, and it was the longest at the time. I don't know if it still is, but it was at the time the longest lockdown at any place had it in the world. And it was also one of the most severe. So they brought in curfews, they had stay at home orders, they had no leaving home except for a very specific, no leaving a 5 kilometer radius of your home. So you literally couldn't travel. And they kept it that way from the end of May until October in 2020.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, there must have been pushbacks against this kind of extended lockdown.
It's interesting because there were, obviously, there were people who were quite upset, but the state really rallied around in support of the lockdown, particularly once it was clear that it was working. You know, I've got a lot of friends in Melbourne who, while they were upset that it had happened and that it was necessary at all, they were very much passionate that it should continue until everyone was safe.
Hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, there were the occasional protest, but the protests really didn't gather more than 100 people here and there.
Has there been the same pushback? They get a lot of this from people saying that, oh, the mental health impact has been significant, or the wait times that it's caused in terms of cancer care are going to be significant, that more people, like, this is worse than what would have happened with COVID. Has there been any of that in Australia? Because that has been a frequent talking point here, which is shocking when you consider that, you know, thousands upon thousands of people have died. But I'm curious if that same discussion happened in your country.
Yeah, so during the lockdown, the exact same messaging was apparent. The exact same points that you've raised. People also said, you know, masks don't work, that the virus isn't as bad as the lockdowns, et cetera, et cetera. There were certainly voices, particularly from the conservative side of politics, that maintained that it was a terrible idea. But oddly enough, I mean, even our Prime Minister, who mentioned or said that he thinks Melbourne should open up in, I think this was July. But fascinatingly enough, when there were when the cases came down to zero, everyone was suddenly very supportive, even those mostly who'd been against it in the first place.
Is there something about Australia that, that allow the government to enact stricter measures and for the population to accept them more than, let's say, the United States? And I know that these, you know, these big comparisons, they're always fraught, but I'm wondering if there's something cultural, if it's political, if there's any indication in your mind of what some of these factors might be.
It's a difficult question, I have to say. I mean, in Australia, we do love our laws. I've got to say that Australians are big fans of regulation, and the first answer of any government in Australia to something that they don't like is to try and pass new laws. That being said, it's not that untrue of most governments in most places. That's what governments do, generally, is pass legislation. And in many ways, we're a fairly libertarian country. The current government of Australia, that, confusingly, I'm sure for you guys, they're called the Liberal Party. They are, in fact, the right-wing arm of the Australian government.
Really?
Yeah, it's wonderfully confusing because the Liberal Party in Australia is right-wing and they use blue as their color, and the Labour Party is left-wing and they use red as their color.
Well, it's the same colors that we have in Canada, which are, again, the opposite of the American colors, because I think because of the British tradition.
We're all British colonies. That's why we have the same colors.
Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, so the Liberal Party takes their name from libertarianism, the small L liberals. And so the idea, and the government in my state, in New South Wales, is also a Liberal government. The government in Victoria is Labour. And yet there's been a fairly consistent approach to the pandemic, even among parties that are philosophically very libertarian.
Well, I feel like that's sort of been the situation here in Canada as well. Like, we have largely not had the same degree of federal, provincial, or arguments that they've had in the U.S., where you had a lot of conflict between the federal government and the various states. There's been some provinces here in Canada where you have, you know, more right-wing governments that were maybe a little bit chomping at the bit to reopen things and sort of did a lot of the lockdowns grudgingly. But I think we were fairly consistent overall in that that this virus was real, that a lockdown was necessary, and that we all had to follow public health recommendations. So at the very least, we weren't, I think, as bad as the United States in that particular respect.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's characterized the Australian response, and from what I've heard, the Canadian response, is that it is local management. So Australian states have all essentially managed the pandemic themselves. The federal government has kind of assisted, but not necessarily been responsible for a lot of the lockdowns, for example. As I said, the federal government kind of encouraged the Victorian government to open up earlier, and they said no. I think that is one way in which the US was at a disadvantage, because there are so many states. And if one decided not to do the same thing as all the others, it kind of completely set off their response. You know, if you have one state that doesn't lock down at all, it and you have open borders between all states, which they do, then whether another state locks down, I'm not sure it will have the same impact.
One of the issues that we had with this decentralized approach, because here too, the various provinces are the ones that have to manage public health, guidelines, have to enforce them. They're the ones who are in charge of healthcare in general. And it's largely been consistent across the country, but there have been instances where different provinces have done different things, and especially now with vaccines, where you have different vaccine schedules in different provinces. And that has caused some degree of confusion, especially people are like, well, why is this province doing that, but this province doing this? Has there been that aspect to it in Australia as well, where people are like, hey, why aren't you guys all playing from the same playbook? And has that led to some degree of skepticism with regard to how accurate the science is?
Look, there's been so many fights, absolutely, interstate wars, where the premier, the leader of different states have gotten into public fights about whether they should do one thing or another, particularly with regards to borders. So one thing that Australia has done very consistently is states have closed borders to each other when there were large pandemics or outbreaks in the other state. So, for example, when the Victorian outbreak happened, most states prevented travel from Victoria into their state. Mm-hmm. And that has caused a lot of friction between the states at times.
I was wondering, Chris, what are your impressions of the contact tracing that we've done in Quebec during the pandemic?
Well, I think the general feeling here is that we did as well as we could, but we were sadly not good enough to prevent the pandemic from taking hold. And the problem with contact tracing is that when you're having thousands of cases per day, you just basically can't do it anymore. If you actually look at the data from here, most of the cases are people who went for testing because they were symptomatic, not because they were being, you know, caught on contact tracing. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it was essentially a failure. But, you know, once you hit a critical threshold, it becomes essentially impossible. We were caught a little bit flat-footed in that we did not have enough people to do contact tracing. We didn't have enough testing kits. There were just so many problems that by the time we got our act together, it was too late. And we were getting thousands of cases per day. And at that point, it's really about controlling the infection rather than trying to prevent it by doing adequate contact tracing. I mean, we've had some famous missteps. I don't know if you remember this, but at one point, when the public health agency here would call people to tell them, you need to get tested, they mm-hmm. were calling from a blocked number, so people wouldn't pick up the phone because they thought it was a telemarketing scan.
Right.
And there was about a week before the government realized they had to unblock the number so that it would say public health on people's call display when they called the phone. So there were some very significant issues, some of which were logistic and unfortunate but understandable, and some of them were just comical. And it really got to the point where it's impossible. Like, if I gave you a name, if I gave you a list with 1,000 names on it, and I said, you call all these people and you ask them for a list of all the people that they've been into contact with in the past 5 days, and you call all of them and get them tested, and then tomorrow I'm going to give you a different list. It's impossible. You can't do it at a certain point.
Gid, what is your impression of contact tracing in your neck of the woods? I guess it would be a lot easier if you have fewer cases.
Yes, I think the key, I agree wholeheartedly with Chris, the key to Australia's success in contact tracing has been keeping cases at a level where contact tracing captures 100% of the cases. So when there has been an outbreak, there was an outbreak in Australia in New South Wales and Sydney over Christmas, started just before Christmas Day, and in total it was a couple hundred cases. When the first case is identified here, the public health authority, New South Wales Health, puts up within an hour or two on a public website and in lots of media across, you know, various platforms, a list of places that person attended, where you either have to be tested, you have to monitor for symptoms, or you just have to be cautious about whether you were there or not. And during the outbreak, that list was about 150, 200 locations.
Okay.
Which means that, you know, they'd called every single person, they'd identified all of their family and friends, they'd also identified every venue that these people had been to, including every public transport, you know, every train, every bus, every ferry. There were restaurants that they'd stopped at for 5 minutes to get a coffee on there. And if you, at the end, by the time they'd corralled all of this information, it was about 30,000 people who were considered close contacts, had to get a test and then self-isolate and monitor for symptoms.
Wow. Yeah, so quickly snowballs.
Yeah, exactly. But it's also a matter of keeping the cases low enough, because as Chris said, if there had been 1,000 people, there would just simply have been too many locations for us to capture, too many people to try and prevent it. And then to drive down cases, you would have had to implement much more restrictive measures. But in this case, in this outbreak over December, there were some restrictions put into place. So we had gatherings limited to 10 rather than to 100, which was what had been previously put in place. But aside from that, life continued mostly as normal. You know, I spent most of Christmas at the beach in fairly large crowds of people. And we went back down to no cases by mid-Jan.
What do you say about the reporting on where these cases have been, so that you can look in to see if you've been to these places as well? Reminds me of what it was like here in Montreal at the very, very beginning when we had our very first cases. I remember hearing in the media like, oh, there was a case and they went from this place to that place and they took the metro and these were the stops, when they were on this line of the metro. And that was very kind of, stressful at first, like, oh my God, was I in this? But that was being reported for about a week at the beginning, and then very soon there were so many cases that you could no longer just report on individual cases and where they had been.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, so as an example of what happened in Sydney, my brother catches the train to work every day. A person who had COVID and was infectious caught the train, the same train my brother does, but he caught it 7 minutes later, and they identified that. And so my brother checked the website, and then he went logged into his transportation cards that tell mm-hmm. you when you traveled.
Oh,
so
nice.
He logged into his account and he could say that, yes, I definitely wasn't on the same train as this guy.
Huh. So in retrospect, and I'm curious to hear from Chris on this as well, do we know what the best approach is now when dealing with the first wave of a brand new pandemic hitting your country?
If I'm talking about the best approach, and I'd love to hear Chris's opinion on this as well, but my personal opinion is that there probably isn't one single thing that you can do that is the best.
Mm-hmm.
Because the countries that have done well during COVID have had really varied responses. South Korea has this amazing technological infrastructure. They passed legislation that allows them to do contact tracing essentially automated, in an automated fashion. They just pull the data in an anonymized way from people's phones and then, again, anonymously notify people who were nearby at the time, which
right.
is amazing. Taiwan has had also an amazing technological edge. Vietnam has had centralized quarantine facilities, lockdowns, masking since the very start. There have been a wide variety of countries that have done things in a very, very different ways, and they've all worked to an extent.
Chris, yeah, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's the thing. There's multiple ways to approach this, and different countries succeeded in different things. I'll throw Greece in there as an example. At the beginning of the pandemic, Greece had done very, very well because they looked at what was happening in northern Italy and said, nope. And they shut down the entire country with a policy that was much more severe than anywhere else. If you wanted to leave your house, you had to text a special code to a centralized authority. And so if you were stopped, your location had to match with what you had texted. So if you said, I'm taking my dog for a walk, if they stopped you, they could check to see what that code was. And you had to have a dog with you. And, so there was very clear control. And they did very, very well up until the summer when they opened up the borders and, things just generally worsened in Europe as a whole, largely because of variants on top of a lot of other stuff. But there's different ways to approach it. It's a question of, are you willing to do something and do it well? Because you can either contact trace and take the positive cases out of circulation. You can quarantine people when they come from overseas, in which case you prevent the cases from getting into the population to begin with. You can have a lockdown so you prevent spread when people get, test positive. But you're all doing the same thing. You're limiting the number of cases so that the overall burden in the community stays low and it's controllable. I think the problem that we had in Canada was that for a long time we did none of these things very well. And that's why the number of cases, especially here in Quebec and in Ontario, got as high as they did. I think there was a lot of resistance at first because people were comparing this to Ebola and the Zika, where people were saying, don't shut down borders. It's going to be harder for us to get aid to these affected areas. And so people were using the same lines from that pandemic. Don't shut down borders. It's going to make things worse. Whereas had we been a little bit better on border controls, people were coming back from overseas and not being screened and not quarantining until a week or two after they had come back, by which point it was probably too late anyway. So if we can, we just have to sort of pick something that we're going to do and do it well and realize that there is no solution. I think in Canada, people would tolerate screening at the airport much more than they would tolerate some of the other things. But that's, again, reflects perhaps our cultural sensitivities more than anything else.
At the risk of sounding like Captain Obvious, I mean, the things that you're mentioning, both of you, are things that we already knew before COVID-19. So is it just that some countries just lack the political will? There were just basically like political issues to enacting these measures because we haven't really learned what these public health measures should be that we should be enacting. Like, we already knew this stuff. It was just a question of applying them consistently. Am I right?
I don't know if I'd agree. So I think, for example, border closures and border restrictions such as Australia has, in the long term, they've been very effective. But immediately in March, they were not really, because by the time we closed the borders and implemented these restrictive quarantine measures, you know, it was already a month into, more than a month into the pandemic. And we already had a fairly large number of people in Australia who were sick at the time. And so at that point, we had to lock down to prevent, you know, more cases from happening. And I think that's actually something that the WHO had modeled prior to COVID-19. They're using previous influenza pandemics, which is that implementing border closures often happens a bit too late to stop the initial cases, because by the time it's recognized as a pandemic, you've already got sick people in your country.
Right.
What it does do, though, is once you've brought the number of cases locally down to zero or near zero, if you have no border measures in place, then new cases will come in. So you have to implement some sort of border measure to capture the cases as they come in and prevent them from spreading in the country.
Yeah, and particularly with COVID, the benefit of border closures now is that we're not importing new variants. I mean, how did the UK variant get to North America? Well, somebody brought it here. When this started first becoming news, I was giving an interview on this, and I was like, well, you know, as long as we keep the border closed, it should be okay. And then the reporter said to me, it's like, do you realize that in the past week, there have been 10 commercial flights from London that landed somewhere in Canada or some number like that? And I was genuinely shocked that there were still commercial airlines flying between London and various cities in Canada. So, and at the time we didn't have, mandatory quarantine in place. So I was like, well, then it's not a surprise that you would introduce new variants into the country, because, I mean, you obviously can't close the border entirely. There has to be some movement of goods and population. But when you limit that number, it becomes much easier to implement a quarantine and make sure that it doesn't break down. So I agree with Gid. Once the cases are there, closing the border doesn't do anything, but it does stop the flood, or it stops the continuous leak of new cases into the country, and at least allows you to deal with the cases you have rather than introducing new cases into the metric. The problem we had in Canada too is, like, right at the beginning, people were traveling, they were going down south, they were going to on vacation to the US, Mexico, the Caribbean, what have you, and they were coming back, and nobody was asking them questions about any symptoms. At the beginning, border agents were told, if people were coming back from China, tell them to monitor symptoms, and anybody else just wave them through as per usual. So there was basically no control going on, and it's what led to a lot of, I mean, the initial cases were all imported, right? Afterwards, it became community spread. But had we been a little bit quicker then, the initial number of cases would have been less, and the exponential growth would have been, at the very least, one half-life delayed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also important to recognize, you know, Australia and New Zealand have arguably the tightest border restrictions in the world. And partly that's because we already have very tight border restrictions. So the government implementing border restrictions in Australia is kind of like, oh, well, I guess that's just what happens. But, you know, places like South Korea and Taiwan, even though they haven't closed their borders in the same way, have managed to keep cases mostly very low. And I think that's because they have other ways to manage their quarantine system. So in South Korea, for example, when people come into the country, they have to give an address that they're going to be at, and no one else is allowed to be at that address unless they're traveling together. And the government will check. You know, the government can, in fact, check their mobile phone data to see that they haven't left, and people come by and make sure that they are still staying where they are for 14 days. I was talking to someone who's in Seoul now, who traveled to Seoul, and she stayed at her parents' apartment, and her parents rented out a hotel room, and she was by herself for 14 days in the apartment until her quarantine was over and she tested negative.
I mean, what you're saying is, I mean, there's an openness to government surveillance. I mean, even if it is anonymized, that we don't typically see all that much in the quote unquote Western world, right?
That's partly it, but I think the other part is mostly what I'm trying to say is that there are lots of ways to do this,
right?
And perhaps Australia, with our very strict rules, isn't the only or even necessarily the best way. It's the way that's worked for us. But I'm sure that in Canada, in the US, in the UK, there are ways to implement similar measures that would be culturally acceptable. There just isn't the same interest in doing so, I think.
In Canada, we just ask politely, and we hope that people will think of their neighbors. You've written recently about lockdowns, Gid, and I wanted to ask you a very simple question that I know has a very complex answer, which is, do lockdowns work, and how do we know the answer to this question?
So this is a very complex, yeah. I mean,
in 30 seconds or fewer, go. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, ask an epidemiologist a question, and usually the answer is it depends, right?
You're the philosophers of the harder sciences, yeah. I guess.
Absolutely. Oh, so yeah, I talked to a journalist friend on and off throughout the pandemic, and she's been saying all the time, epidemiologists, they all say it depends when I ask them questions.
How dare they?
Well, exactly. So I think in this case, though, if I was going to give a very short answer, the answer to do lockdowns work is it depends. I think there's clear and abundant evidence that lockdowns drive down cases in the short term. And that's not surprising. It's an infectious disease. If people cannot contact each other, then obviously there will be less spread.
Right.
It's kind of a no-brainer, and that's been demonstrated by dozens of studies at this point. What people usually argue is, do lockdowns work in the long term? And that, I think, is actually an interesting point, because it doesn't rely so much on the lockdown. So, for example, if you could, in Canada, if you implemented across the entire country tonight, 100% lockdown, no one could leave their house. Within a week or two, cases would start dropping. To be honest, I haven't been keeping up to date so much with the situation in Canada, but, you know, you'd be down to zero after a few months. And that's been demonstrated, you know, in Victoria and in Australia and in other places in the world. But then what you do after that is perhaps the most important thing. Because again, what we've seen is that countries that fully open up their borders, open up all facets of society within the country with no kind of effort to mitigate growing cases, have resurgences of disease.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much a foregone conclusion. You know, that's, again, how the pandemic works. So if you lock down and then, like Australia, like Vietnam, like Mongolia, you implement long-term measures that will prevent new cases from coming in and that mitigate the impact of new cases when they do come in, then I think you could say, absolutely, lockdowns are very effective as a policy long-term. If instead, like the UK, you have a very strict lockdown and then you open everything up and then again you lock down and then you open everything up, sooner or later, you know, you will find more cases happening after the lockdown, unless... And now this is where the kind of the light at the end of the tunnel, unless your population is vaccinated. And so now I think you could say, and particularly towards the end of last year, this was what I was saying, is that probably lockdowns would be most effective over winter in Europe and in other places this year, because by the time the lockdown ends, most of the population will have been vaccinated. And as we've seen in Israel, that will almost eliminate the pandemic, or at least will eliminate the worst parts of the pandemic once you've got 50, 60, 70% of your population vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. And another related question, of course, is, and this has been argued by some more libertarian-leaning people, is do these lockdowns cause more harm than they bring benefits?
So again, this isn't a question that you can only really answer with it depends. So generally, the problem here is there are harms to lockdowns. These are obvious. They're economic. They're social. There are also harms to having an out-of-control pandemic. And these, too, are obvious. You know, we've seen what a pandemic does to the health system. We've seen what it does to social interactions. People are terrified to go on holidays. They're terrified to see their grandparents, that sort of thing, naturally. And it makes sense, because you don't want to get sick and you don't want to get other people sick. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there have been analyses of which one is worse for the economy. And the International Monetary Fund looked at countries that had had very harsh restrictions and countries that hadn't. And, you know, they said that the impact of lockdowns was greater initially, but that potentially the impact of having a lot of cases of COVID long term was worse on the economy. And this is kind of the issue, because both things happen at the same time. Generally speaking, as cases rise, governments panic, the hospital system fills up, and then they implement a lockdown. It's very hard to differentiate the cause and effect there. Do the cases cause issues? Do the deaths cause issues? Or does the government intervention cause issues?
Mm-hmm.
Part of the issue is that if lockdowns do cause problems with, say, cancer screening, which is a claim that is very commonly made,
yeah,
it would be almost impossible to tell, because most of the places that have had lockdowns also have lots of cases, and cases cause an overwhelming of the hospital system, and that reduces cancer screening as well.
Mm-hmm.
So which one of those effects is biggest and which one of those effects is the worst is incredibly hard to understand and to kind of investigate.
It's almost like a chicken and egg scenario.
Exactly. What caused the heart disease? Was it the pandemic? Was it COVID-19? Or was it lockdowns?
Yeah. School closures, what is your opinion on them? Have you looked at the data behind them? What do you think?
I have to say, I'm not the best expert to ask about school closures. It's not the question that's kind of been forefront of my mind. And perhaps that's because I don't have kids at the moment.
that you know of.
That I know of. But
you're such a self-centered epidemiologist. Well, if it doesn't affect me personally, I'm not going to look into the data.
Exactly. But I think it's also because in Australia, schools basically weren't closed. Or at least, sorry, in New South Wales, where I live, schools basically weren't closed. So it was never an issue that was particularly a hot topic here. You know, my mother-in-law is a teacher, and she was teaching remotely for a week and a half, or 2 weeks, I think, in April.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's just been because there have been so few cases that we've never really needed to enact school closures.
Chris Wood, what is your opinion on school closures? Do you have any?
I think it's a little bit hard to say. That being said, though, most respiratory viruses are spread by children, and it's a little bit hard to believe that COVID would be significantly different. And there have been outbreaks in schools and daycare centers here. Not many, but they have happened. So my feeling has been, if you can find a way to do online learning, especially for older students, like people, you know, high school and above, why wouldn't you do it? I agree that school closures are harder for younger children because they can't learn independently at home. Parents have to be home with them. So it becomes logistically harder. But at the very least, for high school and above, I don't see the significant downside. Yes, I agree it's different. Yes, I agree it's harder. But I think you derive enough benefit from it that the costs or the benefits justify the cost, because you have a bunch of people in one room at the same time. That's how the virus spreads. Now, you can minimize that risk by making sure the room is well ventilated, by making sure everybody's wearing masks, and by keeping people distant. The problem that we had here locally was our schools were not well ventilated. Students didn't have to wear a mask in the classrooms, and they weren't keeping them more than 2 meter distance from each other. So
it was
sort of doing everything opposite to what would have actually helped. There probably is a way to keep schools open and minimize the risk. It's just that we didn't, for whatever reason, seem to want to actually do that. And so
We're too polite, Chris.
But I think, you know, I think online learning is a very viable option, especially for older students.
Yeah. I think I agree with Chris wholeheartedly. I also do think it's a point that's worth making, that very young primary school aged kids are very different to high school aged kids. Like an 18-year-old and a 6-year-old have, 10 times different risk from the virus. And also, I think the one point that is important to make, as Chris said, is that kids definitely obviously spread the virus, and the epidemiological evidence is clear that there are outbreaks in schools. So the idea that schools are necessarily, you know, they're free of disease, I don't understand how that idea came about, and I don't understand why it keeps spreading. I think the question is more particularly for younger kids, a cost-benefit analysis of whether the increased spread of the virus is worth keeping schools open. And I think that there are absolutely arguments for keeping schools open even while there are while there is circulating virus. And I think the phrase, you know, last to close, first to open is not unfair, particularly for primary schools. But I think this idea that schools are completely free of disease is something of a motivated conclusion, because the evidence doesn't really support that as far as I've been able to see.
Yeah. Wrapping up here, looking back at the past year, what are the lessons you would want our listeners to take on board from COVID-19, from how the media reported on it, how contrarians sowed fear into the situation, how epidemiology was often distorted to support different positions? Are there lessons to be learned for the general public?
Oh, man, I could talk for an hour just on lessons to be learned.
Please do. Go ahead. There's no limit to our podcast.
You could probably write a book about it.
I mean, if I had you time might. To write a book, I absolutely would. Oh, man. I think, well, my main message to people generally, and it's something that I do on my podcast, something that I talk about a lot in my blog, and whenever people ask me this question, is that things generally are neither as good nor as bad as they're represented in the media. The media is, for better or worse, driven by the need to produce novelty. You know, news. It's called news. It's new. And science tends not to be that interesting, except to a small cohort of people. And, sorry, interesting is not the right word. I think it's fascinating. It tends not to be that novel, because you build new work on earlier work, and it's rare that there's a huge, massive breakthrough.
And it tends not to be very topical either, right?
Well, like, in a pandemic, I think the science became topical.
Sure, yes. Yeah, that was a big difference, yeah.
Yeah, but you're right, yeah. Generally speaking, studies that are ongoing, while they may be kind of pertain to some people's lives, they're not universally interesting. But I think the point is that when someone says everyone's going to die from this brand new pandemic that we know nothing about, they're probably wrong, because we do not have enough information to make that statement at the time they're making it. But equally, when someone says no one's going to die from the pandemic, and I know this for certain, they're probably wrong too. And the media will give both of those a similar level of coverage, because they're both really interesting, novel statements. But when push comes to shove, the person who you really want to be listening to is the guy who says, I don't really know what's happening because there's not enough evidence, but here are some things that are likely, and here are some things that are less likely. And here are things that we can do to kind of mitigate the likely impacts, or make them less of an issue for us, or make them, you know, prop them up, like get some vaccines going. And here are some things that we can do that will hopefully stop the unlikely impacts that we really don't want to happen. And it's that uncertainty that I think is really the key.
Have you found out ways to get people to be more comfortable with this uncertainty? Because I think this is like the holy grail of science communication and skepticism. It's to get people to just be comfortable with the fact that we don't always know. And sometimes we think we know, and sometimes science is just reducing uncertainty. So have you figured out any kind of magical spells to get people to be more comfortable with not knowing?
Look, unfortunately, no. There are some science journalists and health journalists who have experience and topic matter expertise, and who have been doing this for a long time, who are really good at it. But for the vast majority of people who cover COVID-19, who may not have been health journalists before the pandemic, it is really hard to understand and communicate uncertainty. And for your average person on the street who only reads the headlines, you know, something like 80% of all page reads are just the headline, or just the lead of the story, the first paragraph. I know it's a depressing statistic, but it's something that editors everywhere agree with. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a phenomenon. For that person, I don't know if there is an easy way other than to say, remember that most things you read in the news or online are uncertain.
Well, on that note...
Oh, okay.
No, go ahead, Chris.
I want to ask you two questions about the future, but very short answers. Okay. Number one is, are Australia's cases going to start going up again now that winter is coming for you? Yes, no, maybe.
I think winter is less likely to have an impact, but I suspect once the country has had a lot of vaccinations, once mm-hmm. we're up to like 40-50%, we'll open our borders and then we'll see some cases. This is not certain, and this is not this is very much down to the politicians, but I think that's not an unlikely outcome. But there'll probably be cases only in young people, and they'll have minimal impact on our health system.
And my second question for you, just because I like it when people predict the future, do you think vaccination is going to start becoming a regular cyclical yearly thing? Because we're having a lot of debates now about the spacing of the vaccines. And one of the things that never gets discussed is the fact that this may all be a moot point if we're going to get yearly vaccinations anyways.
I think it's almost certain we'll have some sort of booster to the vaccine. This is something that virologists have been saying since March 2020, that the virus mutates in a 3 to 5 year cycle based on other coronaviruses. So it's almost certain we'll have to give booster shots. What exactly that looks like, I don't know.
Well, Gid, on that note of uncertainty, I just wanted to say I really appreciate your tutorials on Twitter when you look at a particular study that just came out that's gotten a lot of hype, and you break it down and you critically appraise it. And I know that I'm not the only one, because I think you've earned a lot of new followers in the past year from doing this kind of work. So thank you for that hard work. If people want to find you and your work online, where do they go?
You can find my Twitter is at GidMK, G-I-D-M-K. My blog's on Medium, I think at GidMK Health Nerd. At GidMK as well. Facebook, I'm at GidMK Health Nerd, but I will say I don't use Facebook very much. And podcast is Sensationalist Science, which you can search pretty much anywhere.
Fantastic, GidMK. Thank you very much for your time and your insight.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And that's the end of our show this month. Our theme music is Fall of the Ocean Queen by Joseph Hackle. Our illustrator is Luke Ouellette. If you want to support the show, find us on Patreon. All of our patrons get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. Our website is bodyofevidence.ca. The show itself can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and Stitcher. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find Chris and me on Twitter as well. And when trying to decide if a study is good or not, remember the Body of Evidence creed.
A study in mice is not a study in people.
Coincidences are easy, proving causation is hard.
Scientific studies are like movies. Some are just bad.
We can't stop at a single study. We have to look at
the body of evidence.